I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where this program's broadcast. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, Aboriginal and Torres Strait elders and non-Aboriginal and Torres Strait elders. Good morning to each and every one of you. And good morning to all our listeners tuned in via the National Indigenous Radio Service, stretched right across this great country of ours. Welcome to Let's Talk. It's great to have your company. Well, Friday, Family Fun Day, National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Day, blackout in Musgrave Park, and it would have been a blackout in a lot of other places across the country as well. A big event down in Canberra on Saturday night, the National, the Gala Ball and what have you, and the awards, the Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Awards were on Saturday night. I haven't got any results of those other than to, I heard Archie Roach won one of the big awards down there again, as you would expect. But we will get you more details, I'm sure, as the day goes on. We'll have those details coming in. But certainly a fantastic day, Friday, in Musgrave Park. And we've still got events. Dusty's been talking about different events happening this weekend. Acacia Ridge has got a gig, got their Family Fun Day on out there on, I think, Saturday. So there's still events happening around the place. And that's one of the real beauties of National Aboriginal Week. It's become National Aboriginal Fortnight or National Aboriginal Month. Before long, we might have National Aboriginal Year. Every day will be a day to feel, to be promoting culture and to be feeling good about who you are, your identity, and about engaging with mainstream Australia. That's a key aspect of National Aboriginal Week, given a platform, given an opportunity to engage. But we've got to create those opportunities every day of our lives. We must engage. Well, maybe not every day of our lives. We need to have a bit of a break from engaging, don't we? But we could be doing it more often. Anyway, my guest this morning, Uncle Bill Chapman, joins me this morning. Uncle Bill, good morning.
Good morning, Tiger.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you. And yourself?
Oh, yes, Uncle. Going well, going well. Now, tell us your country, your mob, Uncle.
I come from Durrumbandy. I'm a Kuma descendant. And I was born on the 12 Mile Abneri Station. And my dad used to open the gate for the traffic that went through there. And that's why I sort of grew up there, and then we went down to a little place called Hebel, where I went to school.
That's down near Lightning Ridge, isn't it, Hebel?
It's on the Queensland, down from Durrumbandy, the Queensland border.
Okay, and a little bit further over is Lightning Ridge.
Yes, you go through Angledale to Lightning
Ridge.
That's
right, yeah.
Yep.
All right. Now, what was life like for you? In those early days for you, I mean, you're known as a rodeo man and a man off the land and stuff like that. You've got a broad range of experience in that area and a big interest in seeing that those skills don't die out, which is as appears to be, but also the link with Aboriginal people on the land and the role of Aboriginal people like yourself, working as ringers and stockmen and drovers and those sorts of roles. So that's what we want to talk about today, and trying to revive those skills, I suppose, to keep those skills going. And you've been involved in some projects to seeing that these skills continue to be passed on. But in getting to that point, tell us about your early days. How far did you get to school?
Well, we went to school at Hebel, and I often tell the young kids today, back when we were going to school, it was a privilege to be allowed to go to a white man's school. But in Hebel, there was no discrimination in Hebel whatsoever, because it was on the Queensland side of the border. And we went to school there, and I made it to grade 3. And then that was the highest I could go, and I was 12 year old. And then I had to go droving, so I went droving with an old bloke called Frank Harper. And old Frank Harper is a descendant of Ned Kelly. And we were getting 10 bob a week. And I went down to a little place called Gadooga, and my cousins was there, and they said to me, "What are you doing for a living?" I said, "Oh, droving." They said, "Oh, no, come with us in the shearing shed." So I went in the shearing shed picking up, and then I learned to shear. Learned to crutch. By the time I was, 17, I had my own droving plant. And we were lucky in them days, because all the people, especially the old stockmen and the blokes that owned the cattle station and sheep stations, they was that eager to give us chapmans, my Uncle Bob and Uncle Pat, the family, all the education of how to manage stock and how to work on stations and all of these sort of things. We were very lucky that these people were so eager to help us.
What do you think that was, Unc?
Well, in those days, as you know, the old black man, he was a very proud race of people. And there were some fantastic ringers. Yeah, back in those days, we had the Aboriginal overseers, we had Aboriginal managers on stations and cattle, sheep and cattle stations, things like that. And, you know, it was, labour was scarce and stuff like that. But
it also sounds like your family, your dad and his brothers, Bob and Pat, it sounds like they'd had established themselves as credible, reliable, honest, hard-working people as well. And they had that respect and credibility in the area.
Yeah, well, Uncle Bob, he went to the war and came home and passed away in his sleep. And Dad had, he had five horse teams, and he used to cart all the wool for the AP Company, which was owned by the Queen, down to Newcastle and cart all the groceries back. So he was and his old brother, he had bullock wagons. So they established themselves in business and stuff like that pretty well, you know.
Way back in the early days, eh?
Way back in those days.
Now, when you talk about a droving plant, just explain to us what a droving plant is. It's all... you tell us, because we've got a lot of listeners here that wouldn't have an idea what a drove... They think it might be something like an orange tree or a gum tree growing in a pot plant or something. Tell us what a droving plant is.
Well, there were two types of droving plants. There was the pack horse one that you had the horses and you put a pack saddle on him and you swag and you had big bags on the side to carry your groceries and all this. And the other plant was a wagonette that was made with wooden wheels and all this sort of stuff, and they had a pole on it, and you put two horses in them, and that carried your food and your swag. And you'd go to a station and pick up, say, 12, 14, 1,500 head of bullocks, and you'd bring them down to the sale yard, or they were sold down from Mount Isa all the way down to Bourke, and it'd take you about 14 weeks to bring them down. And you'd have, with 1,500 head of cattle, you'd have about 10 ringers in those days, and they were all Aboriginal fellas. And the only bloke there white would be the boss man, the drover himself. And you'd have to watch the cattle at night and sing to them. And it was you had a two-hour watch, and you didn't get much sleep, but it was a great life.
All right. You're saying you watch the cattle at night and sing to them. It sort of reminds me of some of those old, early day cowboy movies, old Audie Murphy and
That's
people.
Right.
You'd see them fellas sitting up there singing, playing their guitar and singing the cattle.
This is what
you're saying now, what they used to do here.
And the cost of fuel and everything today, I think droving is, it will have to come back, Tiger, for the stock to be, to be sustainable at the other end of the line.
So you're saying with rising cost of fuel and those expenses today that it might very well be viable to go back to taking them on horseback, droving.
Yeah, well, up in some parts of the territory, they're droving up there again, from Normandon down through Charleville, and sometimes there even now you'll see, seven or eight mobs of cattle on the road. The government has gone around and opened up all the old bores and Wharton reserves on the stock routes, especially down the Canning stock route. That's all been opened up again and new bores put down. So at least the government is looking forward, ahead. The droving may have to come back.
So those stock routes are still in existence. They haven't been taken back or handed over for development or to farmers or pastoral, so that they're still there?
Still the same, mate, still the same.
Hmm.
Yes, the old boars and the old turkey nests, and they've built a lot of new ones and new boars, and you can take cattle back down those old stock routes again.
All right.
Yep.
Today they'd be able to utilise some of these machinery like motorbikes now as well. I see out on some of these, on some of the runs, some of the. The old stock routes and stuff. You'll see cattle and that out there. You see a couple of fellas on a motorbike and a couple on horses and stuff. So they'd be able to utilise some of that. The minimise the cost. They'd be able to get that motorbike in there with the horses and stuff, you think?
Yes. Up around Normanton there, between Normanton and Croydon, there's a couple of stations up there, and what they do with the motorbikes, those big paddocks they got, they send the motorbike on the outside, on the fence side, and he brings sends the cattle in towards the middle to where the men on horses pick them up. You know, where it takes 3 hours to ride over there, a motorbike can be over there in no time at all, and stuff like that. But the problem with the old station today is the wages. Wages haven't changed, but, you know, what a life. You don't have to pay rent. You don't have to buy food. You got a washing machine to do all your washing, and you have Saturday and Sunday off. And there's that many things you can do in the bush and learn and, you know, stuff like that. Those young fellows I took out of Arakoon, my brother and I, we had 100,000 acres of land over at Wyandra. And we took the young fellows from up there. Neville put your much the son, the brother rather, the mayor from Arakoon.
Yeah, Neville, yeah.
Yeah, he was with me and a couple of his cousins. We took seven from up there. And we've got down there to our property, and we've done some fencing, showed them how to peg fencing and, you know, clear the lines and even how to tie a figure eight in a piece of wire, which a lot of people can't do today, black or white. He wouldn't know how to tie a figure eight in a piece of wire. We showed them all these things. And
now, the thing with a piece of eight, tie a figure eight in a piece of wire, was to join up your two ends, your one roll,
right.
One roll to the next one.
That's right.
Mm.
And the old neighbour next door, he come over and he had some fencing to do. He had 8 kilometres to do. So he said to me, he said, would these blokes like to do a bit of work? I said, yeah. And he told me what it was. Well, I said, the rate is $120 a day per man and food. You won't be paying me and you won't be paying your brother, but you'll be paying these other guys. And righto, we went down and I said to the fellow, I said, well, we showed you how to peg it out. Let's show this old bloke now that you're quite capable of doing the job. So it was completed in 7 days, eh? And he said to me, this old bloke, he said to me, you know, I didn't think Aboriginal people would work like these blokes, but he said, they made a liar of me. He said, by gee, they can work. And which they could, Tiger, they would work, you know, 14 hours a day, 10 hours a day, whatever you wanted them to do.
Uncle, you, our mob, people like yourselves and the generation before you, your old dad and his brothers and people, they played a key role in the pastoral industry in this country, out on properties?
Yes, they played a very big part in that sheep and cattle industry. You know, funny thing, I went back to Hebel there at Koala Station where we were working there for a while, Dad was, and we're looking at some of the old fences that George Jerome, which owned the place, his father and my father and my old Uncle Bob put up those fences and dug those holes in that black ground with a crowbar and shovel, bored the post by hand with an old brace and bit. And, you know, those posts are still standing and as solid as the day they were there, and that's over 100 years.
That's a good solid tree that's been cut down and used for a post. What sort of timber do you use?
Well, the old saying is to use for a post is the tree that grows on the land there where you are. You cut him and you put him back in the ground. You bring another tree from somewhere else and he'd just rot away. Is the secret of it?
To use the timber, local timber, local tree.
Local timber that's on the property.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, back in those old days too, women would have played, you would have seen women, and particularly Aboriginal women, I suppose, but you would have seen women on horses and out there in these droving camps too, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of women in the droving camps. And a lot of the women in them days, you didn't know they were women because they were disguised as a man, you know? Wore their hair and everything up underneath the hat and stuff like that, and because, you know, it was sort of being discriminated against a bit. But there were some great stock women out there, there's no doubt about it, and they used to do a lot of cooking for the droving camps. And a lot worked around the station, washing clothes by hand and homemade soap and all that sort of stuff. And that's what we used to have to do every third Saturday or Sunday, make soap for Mum.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah, make soap for Mum.
All right.
But the saddest thing that happened to me was, well, it didn't actually happen to me, but I saw it when I was a young fella, kid, on the Stolen Generation in Angledool. A little place there called Angledool, just over the border from Evil on the Lightning Ridge Road. There used to be 27 pubs in the town once.
Is there anything at Angledool now today?
Yeah, there's three houses.
Right.
And we were there the night that old Bill Prentice and old George Hatfield and the police and the church, and they just went into the camp and they just took babies off women's breasts and out of the beds, and all the kids, 11, 12, 13, they just picked them up like cattle, put them in trucks and took them away. And those old people, you can still hear them wailing there today, Tiger.
True, eh?
On a sad night, you go there and you can hear them wailing.
Mm.
I'll talk a bit about my program that I had, Back to the Bush.
Before you do, I've got a caller on the line. He wants to just make a comment. Let's see. We've got Sean on the line. Let's say good day. Good morning, Sean. Here we are. Yeah, mate. How are you, Sean?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. I used to be an old ringer out for Kidman at Birdsville Way.
All right.
So I remember all the old stuff that happened. Unfortunately, like you said, and I think the previous one of your previous comments were about the wages not being right.
Yeah.
I had to come back to the city to get another job to make the wages. So I loved riding the horses in the stocking.
Wasn't much money in it, eh?
There's not enough money in it, and I'll tell you what, some of the best people that I sat down and had a beer with were Aboriginal fellas.
Yeah, right.
Just being able to sit in on a Sunday and have a beer with them, and they'll tell you about what they used to do in the past, it just absolutely blows your mind. It's something that city kids need to go and do.
Was there a few of our mob, Sean, working with Kidman, working for Kidman when you were out there?
There was a couple of young fellas, but a lot of the older fellas were in town working for the council.
Right.
But, they could ride, and unbelievable the amount of knowledge they had that they could pass on, but there's no one there to listen.
Yeah. Well, that's what my guest Billy Chapman's about today, trying to see that we can round up them young fellas and get those skills back into the younger generation.
Well, even if the black fellas want to go back out there, that's where they come from, but even the city kids need to be sent out to learn a bit of respect. Yeah. I'll tell you what, I get a few apprentices through here. I work for Hastings as a fitter. I'll tell you what, I've seen a lot of city kids without respect, and I've been out a lot of bush, a lot of places, and there's nowhere near the respect in town that you get out there.
Yeah. I need some good life skills, eh?
That's it, mate. That's it. Have yourself a good day and play some good tunes for us today, Tiger, mate.
No worries, Sean. Thanks for your call, mate. You have a good day, too.
Cheers, Blake.
Thanks, mate. There's Sean, another bloke that's worked for Kidman. Be a name that you'd know, Unc?
Yes.
Yeah. And
talking about Kidman, funny thing, there's an old butcher up at Normanton, old Doug. And he said to me one day, he said, all these people here reckon I'm racist, Billy. He said, I'll show you something. He went out the back and he came back with his big old album. And there was his mother and his father and his sister. He said, now, Dad managed this station for Kidman. Now, the photo of old Kidman on a horse and everything. And there's Mum and Dad. And he said, see this next photo? Here he was. His mother had no milk for him when he was a baby. And being in the Gulf, you know how dark they are. Here he was. And he's on the breast. Now, he said, this Aboriginal woman fed me and saved my life. And he said, and these so-called fellas around here reckon I'm racist? he said, when we saw white fellas, me and my sister, he said, we ran away. We never seen white people. We took off. He said, all we've ever grew up with was Aboriginal people, Bill. He said, and I know each and every one of these.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. But,
lots of stories like that around,
eh? Oh, mate, yeah. This old guy, he's got a full big album of all the roving trips that his father done with Kidman and,
All right. Now, you've got a bit of a concern that some of these skills, these skills of ringers and drovers and horsemen. I mean, you did some rodeo stuff. Let's talk about some rodeo stuff. You ended up making a bit of a name for yourself.
I started rodeo, and when I was only 12 years old, I rode Bullock at Brewarrina with some of the great old cowboys, and I went down the road with blokes like Bonnie Young, Barry Crawford, old Ray Crawford, Alan Bennett, Wally Woods, Normie Woods, Alan Woods. I spent 3 years touring with Gill Brothers, riding bucking horses 6 nights a week with them fellows.
Chilisini was a name around when I was growing up.
Yes, I rodeoed with Chilisini and another guy in Ipswich, Henry Doyle. Rodeoed with Wally Mailman and old Lenny Mailman.
All right.
Aboriginals.
Yeah.
I rode buckles with Mike O'Malley and Tony Tarani and those blokes when they were singing for Noel George. I travelled with Buddy Williams. I rode bucking horses before the Queen and Prince Charles. She gave me a little cup and a piece of red carpet.
All right, yeah.
I've been on a fishing boat with old Lee Marvin. And the other thing that happened to me in Ipswich, or Brisbane rather, you know the award, the big medal that Griffith University gives out to all the academics, doctors and lawyers and barristers?
Mm.
Well, I was the first Aboriginal to ever receive that gold medallion from Griffith University.
All right.
I got that a couple of years ago.
What were they recognising your...
For the 25 years of the work that I did in the community.
All right, yeah.
Mm.
Right, gee, eh? What's your radio work? There would have been a lot of our mob...
Oh, mate,
there
were some great bronc riders in the Aboriginal people, yes, great bronc riders. Blokes like Harry Zoot, Johnny Crombie, Jackie Crombie, he was in that robbery under arms with Peter Finch.
All right.
Oh, there were some great bronc riders. But it's a bit of a racist game, that rodeo business.
Is it really?
Oh, yes. Yes, it's a bit of a racist game. I started the IRRA, which is the Indigenous Rodeo Riders Association, for our Indigenous people. And I run rodeos up in far as Bamiga, Weeper, Kurrinyana, Arakoon, across Western Australia, Normandon. I run a big rodeo, just finished a big rodeo at Normandon. There were 68 Aboriginals there in the local station bronc ride.
When was that?
That was the Queen's birthday weekend.
This year now, gone?
Yep.
All right, yeah.
And we've got another one coming up in September.
Back up there, Normanton?
At Normanton.
All right.
Yep.
And you had 68 Aboriginal riders there?
In the open station bronc ride.
Really?
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yep, fantastic.
And you say, like, how did the mainstream, the ARRA, and is there the professional rodeo riders?
Well, the ARRA went to the professional rodeo riders.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, the ARRA was formed in 1946 in a little restaurant in Sydney one night. And it went right through till it become the APRA, which is Australian Professional Rodeo Riders.
Right.
But
and how did they react to you establishing the Indigenous Rodeo Riders Association?
Oh, well, they wanted me to join them. They wanted me to be a subsidiary of them.
Right.
But I wouldn't do that. I thought that because it's an Indigenous Rodeo Riders Association and it's open to all people, we don't discriminate against anybody. You can come and ride. Anybody can ride at our rodeo, but it's strictly an Aboriginal board of directors and all that sort of stuff. And we don't get any funding from the government, none whatsoever.
So you just raise the money by nominations and stuff?
Nominations, yes.
Sponsors?
And sponsors.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's a big job.
By gee.
And I've been president and I've still got the original committee I started with in 82. And I can see a need for it, you know. We got some great bull riders and bronc riders up there in that round from Townsville up.
All right.
There is cowboys up there. Well, for instance, that old chainsaw that used to be bucking with Gary McPhee.
Yeah.
There's a little Aboriginal fella from Doomadgee. He rode him.
Done the 8 seconds?
Yep.
All right.
But there was nothing ever printed about him.
Okay.
You know, because an old mate of mine, a daddy windy old Colin McTaggart, said to me, why wasn't it written? Well, I said, Colin, he's black.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
They don't want to go riding about black people riding chainsaw.
Black achievement, yeah.
Yeah. It's like myself. There's three of us. Henry Doyle, which is an Indigenous bloke from Springshaw. Another little bloke from Jeffrey Anderson from Proston and myself. We won 52 bulldoggins in 52 weeks. But
really,
nothing was written about us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fantastic achievement.
Yeah, but yeah. It doesn't worry me because we know we did it.
That's right. You know what you've done. Now, you were also involved with young fellas, weren't you? Like young teenagers, riding?
Yeah, we run some schools up in the Gulf and the Cape. I can't get Ipswich interested in it. They just... I don't know, they're not horse-minded here, yet there is some good stockmen.
You would expect Ipswich to be one of the first ones to put their hand up.
You would think so.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I said to the mayor the other day, but I said they won't.
Yeah.
But my other interest is in young people. When they, you know, got land rights and they had all these cattle stations and everything, and I went around talking to some of the old ringers, so I got registered a program called Back to the Bush. Back to the bush is from 15 to 25, or 30, whatever. And first place I kicked off was up in Normanton. I got a mate up there, a little place on the Gilbert River, bloke named Warren Bethel. He'd been trying to get a program set up, but he didn't know how to go about it. So we picked up 25 street kids and young fellas running around Normanton that hadn't had a job or couldn't get a job and all this sort of stuff. So we took them out there onto the Gilbert River and we lined them up the next morning. We said to them, well, we want you for 3 months. We'll teach you the skills and show you enough skills to get you a job. Then it's up to you to learn from the bloke on the station. Now, the biggest problem, as you know, is you can't run these programs on an Indigenous property because they don't have the facilities. And the next hardest part is to get that white man to say, well, yes, come out here and use my place and we'll go ahead and we'll help you teach them. Well, we took those guys out there and we had them there for 3 months and we used to put them onto these different stations. We showed them all about, you know, kill a bullock, cut out a rope, how to twist a rope, how to make head rope, leg rope, how to break a horse in, how to throw a Mickey by the tail, how to tip his horns and all of these sort of things, Tiger, and how to cut up a bullock and salt his meat and fresh meat and soft meat and all sort of stuff. And some of them kids, when we come out on the stations, my job was every week I'd go around station to station. And the first place I went to was to the boss. How's this kid going? Oh, fantastic. Then you go down and you talk to the kid, how you going? Oh, well, I don't really want to be a ringer, I want to be a machinery operator. Okay, stay here. You only got another 2 weeks to stay here and I'll get you into a machinery operating job. And that's what I did with them.
All right. They move on to jobs, actually work and develop their skills further on properties, on stations?
Well, I did that course. That's 4 years ago. I ran them courses for 3 years. I think there were 60 people, and those people are still in the original jobs that I got for them.
All right. Now, there's some people thinking that this hasn't been done. I've heard... I heard somewhere in the media recently that there was a white fella program that's going to do these and has never been done before and stuff. Again, you got yourself, the Aboriginal man, that's done this stuff 4 years ago. You did it for 3 years, so there's 7 years back you started. And little known about it. So it's good that you're able to tell our listeners that
yep.
You've certainly done that. You think that it'd be... There's still a need for that, Bill, surely, like for these those sorts of opportunities and skill development. There's still a need for that, isn't there?
Mate, these poor people, will you take Arakoon Station? Arakoon Station used to run 40,000 head of cattle. Arakoon was the first cattle station in the Gulf to bring cattle by road, walk them down to Mareeba Meatworks. They used to have about 40 ringers on them places up there. On those outstations, but on Wathaneen alone, they used to run 7,000 head of cattle on Wathaneen Station. It would be one of the greatest cattle properties you ever seen. But today, well, they got no fencing, there's no ringers, there's no horses, there's nothing, nothing whatsoever. And they advertised a position there for a station manager. I put in for the job. They flew me up to Cairns and interviewed me and guaranteed me the job. But Aboriginal politics stopped it at the other end.
Got in the way, eh?
Got in the way.
Why is it that that property that was run, that was quite a, an outstanding property, 40,000 head, now doesn't have anything? What happened there, do you think?
Well, the government, when they bought Arrakoon Station, the ILC, they went in, they mustered what they could by chopper, and what they couldn't muster, they shot. And then they removed everything, like the stove out of the house, the gates off the fences. Ever seen a property after the ILC has bought it and handed it over?
No.
Well, I've seen them take the doors off the houses, take the water troughs, take the stoves.
What's the reason for that, you think?
Well, they don't want the old black man to go in there with a fully with the station that's got everything on it, do they?
Doesn't make a lot of sense, Bill.
And they won't even give you enough money to buy an iron post.
What would it take now then for someone like yourself or the interested parties like Arrakoon Council to resurrect some of these sorts of properties? I mean, even just up at Warrabinda, Sherberg, they've got properties running. What, how are they going?
No good.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Is it politics? Is it policies developed by government? What is it?
It's policies developed by the government. I've got a friend, and she breeds those Wagyu cattle.
They're supposed to be that good eating one, eh? Good for the plate, the kitchen.
Well,
restaurants.
Mate, if you can afford to buy Wagyu fillets, go and buy one.
Yeah.
It'll melt in your mouth.
Good tucker, eh?
It's 2.5 minutes to cook him and let him sit and eat him.
All right.
But she bought a property next to Warrabinda, and now she wants to get in there through me and show those guys up there how to grow Wagyu, cull the cattle, spay what's there that's no good, fatten them and sell them and all this sort of stuff, and how to breed a herd. Now, for instance, she gets $15 to $18 a kg for her bullocks in the paddock, and the exotic breed, the old Brahman over the road there, he's flat out getting $3.
By gee.
So see the difference?
Makes a lot of sense to go with that Wagyu mob.
Wagyu, the best beef I've ever eaten in my life.
And is there any chance that this might happen, where Aboriginal people like at Warrabinda might be able to do something like this?
Oh yeah. We're
you're working on it?
We're working on it.
Good.
The program's been put together, and her husband is a bit sick at the moment, but as soon as everything's right, we're going up to talk to him, and one thing or another. And the other big project we got going, and this is with the help of the government or on behalf of the government, is the Australian camel for the last 5 years have been scientifically proved that the milk of a camel will make insulin in the body. And we looked at people up in King Valley outside Alice Springs. We've spoken to all the Aboriginal people across there where the camels are, and they're so eager to start, mate, it's not funny.
And there's a lot of them camels running like just wild out that way, eh?
Just running wild.
Yeah. So you see there's an opportunity there to harness these camels and start milking them.
Yep. With the help of the indigenous people.
Yeah,
but then
the Mobile country.
They own the country, they own the camel too. And what we want to do is get it established, get all the markets established, and in 10 years, hand it back to them.
Yeah, yeah.
And let them carry on. And the same thing up at Warrabinda, you know, let them go right ahead. I was talking to Curtie Noble up at Pomeroy this morning, and big problems up there. Big problems. In the management of the cattle stations.
Right.
Yeah. It was just given to a local rope that he wouldn't know which end of the bullock eat the grass.
I'm still thinking about this image of milking a camel, Uncle. I mean, I used to sit out on a stool when I was a kid. A camel, a bloke, you get a young one, he can stand up and do the job.
Yeah, you won't get a backache milking a camel, will you?
No backache there.
Yeah, I used to milk them old cows and sit on the bucket and get kicked and get hit in the butt there with the tail.
And get that foot in the bucket if you didn't put the leg wrap on. You travel around a bit, it seems. You go up to the Gulf Country a bit and stuff. How do you feel when you walk around and you see young fellas? You see our mob with a few issue, our young people and that, and you can see there are properties around. How do you? What would you like to do when you see a young mob? Are you interested? Do you want to get a program going again where you can start up with some young fellas around teaching
mate,
skills?
I'd give me right arm to do it. But finding a property, like I went into Doomadgee. I flew into Doomadgee and I put the first rodeo on in Doomadgee, the first one that ever held for 15 years. And I looked at all the young people, and Doomadgee one time, with the 17 outstations, never received any money from the government. It was self-sufficient way back years ago, until they were set free. As the old-timers will tell you up there, they say it was a sad day when they set us free. And, you know, you talk to them people and you see the young people there, and there's $32 million of the taxpayers' money goes into Doomadgee, but there's nothing for the young people. I ran a course up there, fencing and yard building. Well, mate, they were there at 9 and 10 o'clock at night. They were there daylight next morning. You had to run them home to get out of the way so you could get some sleep. All they wanted to do was talk about ringing and catching their cattle and doing this and onto the outstations. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
But there's nobody.
Maybe there's somebody around down this way that might want to, if they ring up the station looking for you, it'd be right to give their number. If it's people, I've had a few people sort of talk over the last couple of years. Oh, we'd like to be able to get a program happening, teaching young fellas the skills of the bush and that.
Yep.
You'd be keen to talk to people if anyone made a call?
Not a problem.
All right, then. Well, we'll see if there are people out there that are interested, people with properties, people that are keen to see the skills of the bush revived and taught, continued on. You can certainly call the station here and we'll link you up with Uncle Bill Chapman. Well, Uncle, it's probably getting closer time for us.
Yes.
Anything you'd like to say in winding up?
Well, I just hope something that, somebody does give me a call and say, well, I've got a vacant farm at such and such a place and you want to do some training for these young people. Of course, it's not a problem of getting them onto a position on a cattle station once you've shown them.
Once they've got the skills, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had one young fella there at Normanton, little fat fella he was.
Yeah.
And he was the last man in the camp. Last man in the camp to get a job. All the boys said, oh, you won't get a job, you're too fat, blah, blah, blah. How they go.
Yep.
Anyway, this old bloke rang up Warren, and he said, yeah, we've got one fella left. He said, that's funny. He said, I know that bloke's father and his uncle. He said, they were good ringers. He said, can you bring him out? Oh, we had to take him about 200K, you see. So Warren and I, we put him in the thing and away we go. Put him in the jeep and took him out. He went out there. He was there 6 weeks before Christmas. And we said to him while we were going along, Warren knew this old bloke at Woodland Station. He said, this bloke, if he says to you, we're going to go down and check that fence, and do a bit of repair work on the fence. So he said, you know you need a chainsaw, an axe, a crowbar, pliers, wire, strainers, water. Don't be told a second time, put it in the truck, the next morning. Get up and don't put in the thing. Anyway, he was there for 7 weeks. The old bloke said to him, well, it's Christmas time, son. He said, I better run you to town. So he went in about 4 days before Christmas. He ran him into Normanton. He was there 2 days. And these are the words of the old fella. He rang him up and he said to him, listen, you mind if I come back out to the station? He said, why? Don't you want to have Christmas in there? No, he said, all they're doing is smoking marijuana, drinking. He said, I want to go back out in the bush. Old bloke said, I'll be in town Christmas Eve, I'll pick you up.
Good one, eh?
He picked him up and took him back out, and that's 4 years ago, and that bloke's still there.
He knew where the place to be was?
Yes.
Out of town.
Out of town.
All right, Uncle. Well, listen, thanks a lot for joining us this morning and sharing those experiences with us. It's certainly good to hear that, people like you are still around and keen to train, keen to teach people.
When we start this milking these camels, we'll talk again.
Most certainly will.